Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 639. New episodes of At Midnight are not being made this week. This would be the week of February 16th through the 20th. We will return next week on the 23rd with a very special episode with Paul F. Tompkins and two of the puppets from No, You Shut Up is going to be the panel. So I'm very excited about that. And then we'll be back on for a while. Also adding second shows to the Fun Comfortable Tour. A bunch of new tour dates and cities are going to be announced, I believe, next week. But second show has been added in Chicago at the Athenaeum. The first show is sold out. Go to funcomfortabletour.com for info about that. Events from the Nerdist community, from people like you, or possibly you, who have personal projects and things that they would like to signal boost. So, first of all, October 23rd to the 25th in Yakima, Washington, the first Comic-Con in Yakima is going to be hosted there. They're in the process of finding vendors and talent and artists, so if anyone's interested in being part of the show, go to their website at centralcitycomiccon.com and fill out an inquiry on the contact page. Also, Tuesday, March 3rd at 5 p.m., they're going to be meeting with potential volunteers and have ideas to kick around. They're meeting at the Engagency at 521 West Yakima Avenue. Again, centralcitycomiccon.com. Also, Reen Roberts has written a nice email. I've listened for a couple of years now and finally learning to enjoy my burrito. I've started to sell my photography. Good job, Reen. Never able to show anyone beyond my family, and he's very excited and putting it out in the world. So go show him some support. He is at Etsy.com. Balanced Pictures is his Etsy store. So go check that out, and congratulations to you, Reen. If you have a community corkboard idea you want to submit, events@nerdist.com, events@nerdist.com. This episode is Simon Helberg, who I've known for a couple years now, a spectacularly cool dude. He, of course, is on The Big Bang Theory, but he's promoting his movie that he co-wrote and directed with his wife called We'll Never Have Paris. It is not in theaters anymore, but it should be out on VOD or Blu-ray very soon. So go look that up. We'll Never Have Paris, Simon Helberg. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. So, sure, shave technology is great. Vibrating handles, paddle wheel blades, a laser pointer, compass, thermometer, an accelerometer. Okay, those aren't all on a razor, but you get the idea. These are a lot of things that you don't necessarily need or want on a razor. So that's why you should make the switch to Dollar Shave Club. They deliver amazing razors, grooming supplies for just a couple of bucks. It takes 2 minutes to sign up, and then you never have to worry about razors again. They're going to give you a free handle, and then they send you the replacement blades for just a few bucks. You get new blades every month or every other month if you want, but they will arrive like clockwork. So don't have to think about it anymore. You don't have to go to the drugstore and have someone come over and open up the case so you can get a blade that's probably going to tear up your face and cost too much money. So use Dollar Shave Club. Upgrade to the smarter way to shave. Get your shave gear where everyone here at Nerdist gets theirs. DollarShaveClub.com. Shave time. Shave money. DollarShaveClub.com/Nerdist. That's DollarShaveClub.com/Nerdist. Here's Nerdist Podcast episode number 639 with Simon Helberg.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We're almost done.
What? Yeah.
How'd it go?
It's a good conversation.
Yeah. You were really awesome.
I'm really good at this.
Yeah. I just did what I thought you would have done. Yeah. Which I talked about you for most of the time.
Good. Good. That'll be all, Jonah. That'd be great if we had a trapdoor in here. I would so love to just... Yeah.
Get rid of me?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Just one trapdoor.
Just one trapdoor. I'd get stuck in it, really. I'm just like, huh?
Yeah.
Just halfway in.
Yeah. Yes, that's the...
It's even worse now.
The comedy
now
of it.
Never
yeah, yeah.
It would be fantastic.
I have that same key, but it's at the valet.
Oh.
I don't want to drop names.
Of course you do. You guys all got raises.
Of course you...
I'm sure you must have 9 of these.
Yes, and I have a personal valet. He comes with me everywhere.
Is it Kyle? Awesome. Kyle's my personal valet.
That'd be so awesome if you could just have like a guy in a bow tie next to you and you'd be like, all right, just pull up to the meter and be like... Just
like Arthur?
I guess that's what...
Yeah.
I want a John Gielgud in my life.
Yeah.
Just always. Just
yeah, I was there for you.
A hilarious older gay butler.
Yes.
Who is always there to provide insight and be my surrogate father.
If you were still drinking, you'd probably need one.
I think I probably
yeah.
would be.
Yeah, yeah. Be oh court my. Appointed.
I would just make some court appointed guy wear a tuxedo all the time just to carry me around. Mm. But how have you been? I never, we're all so busy. I never get to see you.
I know.
God damn it. I grumble.
I stand outside the door here and I wave to you, but apparently it doesn't make an impression.
I'm very busy.
You're busier than me.
I yes. don't know if that's true.
No. Well, you are. Well, you have like four, five, six things.
But
happening.
You also, okay, but in addition to your show, which takes up time, you also have this movie, which would have yes. taken up time. Now you're doing all the press for that movie. Which...
Yes. Yeah. Even though the movie is only 90 minutes, it took longer to shoot. If it was a 90-minute commitment...
It's not a one-er? Just an
it
entire...
Wasn't, no, it wasn't in real time. I really signed up for more than I was able to handle. I thought that... Because I am on a TV show, and I thought...
Yeah, it's the same thing.
10 to 5, like, you're... Yeah. Yeah. The movies like, right. don't work that way, but
no, apparently. I mean, Birdman is a one-er, right?
They shot that in a weekend,
yeah.
I think.
Didn't they just all kind of like show up?
They all showed
yeah.
up. They all showed up on a Friday.
Mr. Norton, Mr. Keaton, Mr. Oh, Keaton, Mr. Norton,
and roll it.
Yeah, all yeah. right.
Now
all
right. roll in the real-time special effects.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. that's why Keaton actually learned how to make things levitate with his mind.
Yes, that's right.
Because he's that good.
Yeah.
But no. yeah, and then by Sunday they all just went home.
Yeah, it sounds great. I thought that's why it seemed like a blast. But it took a long
what
time.
Fun they had!
Yeah, I think the way that it worked was that they shot it. They met on a Friday, shot it on a Saturday and Sunday, and then Monday it came out.
Right,
and
it was part of a 24-hour film festival. Yeah,
yeah, yeah that's right.
Did you like the filmmaking process, or were you spoiled by sitcom schedule?
Oh my god, it's so hard. I don't know. I think I mean, I'm probably a bit. Spoiled, but I think there's got to also be an easier way to potentially make a film. But you know, when you're making it in 22 days and on a small budget, we also had to deal with this heat wave in New York. It was the worst heat wave in 40 years, apparently. Jeez. And then when we did posts in New York, it was the polar vortex, the worst winter. So it was like a mythical, literally like the gods were trying to stop us from making this.
Of all the places in the country, New York really gets punched in the
really
face
does.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
yeah.
In a lot of different ways.
I know. It's yeah.
You gotta be tough to live in New York.
Yeah.
yeah.
And I'm not tough. Yeah.
But it's worth it because once you get to summertime, the smells.
It's true. You know what people ate last week. Yeah. So I was there for summertime and that was it was grueling, but I did and I had to do so, you know, I wrote it and I co-directed and produced it it was a lot of pressure and I lost 15 pounds making the movie also.
You can't spare that.
I know. That's what I was trying to tell my body, but I apparently anxiety is a magical thing. It was horrible. I mean, you see in the movie like I like lose weight, but it's out of sequence
because
it wasn't a one-er. I eventually caved in. We had to shoot it over a period of time and out of sequence. And I there'll be like a scene where I'm like 10 pounds skinnier in the middle of the movie and then I'm back. But it's
weird,
you know, but I lose it all from, it's all ankle weight. So yeah. you can't, it's not,
you know,
it's
I just thought that it's more like artistic choices that you were making. So
yeah.
You know, these are like the subtle.
Well, Jake Gyllenhaal changes. Did it. And I was like, what if I just lost 15 pounds?
What if I made my eyes look like they're bugging out of my face?
Yeah.
The creepiest weight loss was Christian Bale in The Machinist, which
that was weird.
Is fucking disturbing.
Yeah. Well, these people are, that's just not healthy.
No.
Because I had heard, you know, his wife was like during the shooting of, I think, of The Machinist, she was like, at night, she was like, the phone rang, she was like, Christian, and he was just like, I think he was like dead. I think he like, I mean, that was it. And what I'm trying to tell you is he died.
He died.
Yeah, sorry.
Someone took over, though. Some other guy is doing it now.
I guess he'll have to scream at God to get out of his eye line now.
Exactly. Yeah, but no, but these people...
They called a stand-in from Empire of the Sun to come back. And
yeah.
Turns out he aged to look just like him.
Yeah,
it's
like Dorian Gray. Yeah. It was really smart thinking. But, oh man, that tape was so good of him yelling at the guy.
Yeah.
I think he maybe since apologized for that.
But then didn't he hit his mother while he was trying to apologize? But then his mom was like, Christian, I think if you're going to say so, he's like,
He just hit her in the face.
He just punched her in the face. Like, oh, another fucking apology.
And then, like, a month later,
he just keeps hitting the people that are
Please, can we stop asking him to apologize?
Yeah, yeah. Please, just let him.
It's his trigger. Stop with these buzzwords.
These buzzwords like apologize.
Yeah.
Please be sorry.
What'd you say?
What'd you say?
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Don't hit me repeatedly. It's the movie making process. I would imagine. I imagine it drives people insane.
It does. It made me so happy to have. To have a dressing room like on the show. I have these luxurious things, like a place to go to the bathroom that is with a door, and then even a place to sit and
a toilet.
One of those. And so, I mean, this movie was, people were passing out from heat stroke, and like my wife ended up in the hospital after a rap party from exhaustion. I mean, it was insane. Then we had to go to Paris and shoot 3 days in Paris, and like a third of the movie takes place there. So we just shot. Like some of it guerrilla style, I don't even know how we got permits. I can't imagine it was totally legal. We shot in the Naval Museum, and they were like, you can shoot here, but if somebody high up in the French government or military dies within 10 days, we are not going to allow a film crew, but we'll have to drape it in these flags, and there will be soldiers. And I was like, and I all of a sudden got very involved in French politics.
Just watching.
I was like,
you jumping and taking a bullet. For
exactly. I was
like, worth it.
I was like, we need to protect these men.
Vive la France!
I was out there like a Navy SEAL jumping into the waters and into the Seine. And look, I protected those guys, and we shot that scene, and it was great.
And ultimately...
Yeah. Yeah,
a film was made.
Yeah, exactly. So it was. It is hard. But out came, and it is a personal story. So that it was like the layers of just anxiety and stress and when you care about things, I found out. I think the key is indifference. That because if you don't care, everything's cool. I mean, I kind of recommend that. I don't care enough to recommend it,
but if I were the type.
Like, when you're at at a coffee shop and people are just like those guys that are there like every morning.
Yeah.
Like at the coffee bean. Like, who's a regular? I mean, I guess I am. I'm the worst. Like, I'm a regular at places and I judge all the regulars for being regulars.
Yes.
Who are, when you go to McDonald's and you look around, you're like, oh, look at the people who eat at McDonald's.
It's like one of those things where it's like, oh, he goes here all the time. Yeah. I see him every time I'm here.
I come here just to judge you.
Yeah, exactly.
A happy meal.
Yeah, they see you there every time.
Yeah, and it's like, at least I don't enjoy coming here. Yeah. Judge myself too. You probably don't even judge yourself. You're probably healthy. Yeah. You probably think this is okay. Yeah. You accept who
Simon
you are.
Doesn't
You're
seem here. Very happy.
Yeah.
Look at these people accepting who they are. Yeah.
Look at these people being disgusting. Look at these people with their smiles.
Yeah. Smiles
and
content.
Their happy kids.
Well, I'm on my way to therapy. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
Grumble, grumble, grumble.
Yeah.
My therapist will tell me I'm okay.
Yeah, he's like, you have some barbecue sauce on you. Shut up!
You have barbecue sauce on your soul.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have it.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's sad.
Well, yeah. I think this is what you should be doing because listen, your show's not going anywhere for a while.
You mean in a good? You're not like your show's not going anywhere.
No. I mean your show.
You mean it's not
going
to go off the air. You're
not
going to
go off.
It's not
going
to.
No, it already got there, Simon.
It's not. Hey, listen, buddy. Your show's not. Nothing's going to happen.
That's why we brought you on. It's not. I mean,
we can only send you those fake numbers for so long.
I think there is no NBC.
Wait.
NBC collapsed with the great media implosion of 2011.
The Nielsen ratings went out the window with Mork and Mindy. So.
Yeah.
We've just been keeping... This is like... Have you seen The Truman Show?
But it's... I mean, the show's not going off the air
anytime
soon. But I think it's still... You need to explore other things. Like, you can't just do you creatively. It's like, you get into a certain place where you know what to expect at work every day, and you need to play with other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think people think like, well, this is it. Like, you made it, and you're doing it, and you're on the show, and people know you as this guy, and like. That's the dream, and in a lot of ways, it is the dream. But I guess it's more it's a dream. It's a part of this. I'm sure you. I mean, I don't know. Like I don't feel done because I feel like if I say like I've
I've made it, then to me that sort of implies like, and I'm done. Like, I'm ready to be to check out or something. And I'm probably a little too. I feel like I'm too driven for my own. Did I mention I lost 15 pounds just during this podcast?
Yeah, yeah. I can tell from the beginning.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think I need to like to cool out a little. But then I'm always afraid if I cool out a little that I'll like lose my mojo or something. And then
the fire in the belly.
It is. It's
keeps you step ahead.
Yeah, that's called colitis. That fire. Yeah.
But I think it's important because it's. The show eventually will stop because that's just the way things
hey,
work.
Hey, come on.
No, I mean in 100 years.
Okay.
But you've always been consistently working since I've known you.
Yeah, no, yeah. I've been lucky. Like I work really hard and then along comes this show and you're like, okay, I'll do this pilot about God again, these nerdy characters like, oh, I have to mention Stephen Hawking. Like I said to my agent when I read the pilot, I was doing Studio 60, and this is not a secret. I mean, Chuck knows this. I'm not being jaded here about this, but I didn't want to audition for the Big Bang Theory because I was on this coveted great show, or at least what kind of seemed to potentially have greatness in it, which was Studio 60 and Aaron Sorkin, all these great people, and then along came a show about nerds, and that's all I had ever played until this Sorkin show. And it was like, I was like, I don't want to abandon this thing. And I'd done six pilots and they never got picked up because that's what happens. And I sort of got convinced to at least audition. And then I was like, well, I mean, it was a great script. And eventually like, my gosh, thank God I did. And I remember writing to Aaron Sorkin saying like, listen, I'm so sorry. I hope that you understand, but I got this pilot, and because I wasn't technically a regular on Studio 60, but I did like almost all of them. So they had to let me out, but I wanted him to know how much I cared about the show. And I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to shoot this show, and I hope you'll understand if it doesn't get picked up. I'd love to continue to be on your show, and maybe even if it does. And he wrote back, you fucking asshole.
Oh,
and then he wrote,
shit.
Just kidding. And I was like, oh my God. He's like, they would have to pry the pen out of my cold, dead hand to stop writing for you. And I have this email.
Oh, that's
like,
so sweet.
And I was like, oh, that's so amazing. Like, he was so supportive of that decision, and I eventually, I guess it was a good decision because that the big.
In the next episode, your character on his show gets if Studio 60 had kept going, your character would have been decapitated.
Yeah, exactly.
And your body pieces would have been divided up.
Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah. How did he? An IED. This is a sketch comedy show. Why are there IEDs on the set?
It would have been really funny if they. If they gave Studio 60 a lot of notes, and all of a sudden it's like it started becoming more about the White House, where it's like, well, the government's come in and they've taken over this sketch comedy show.
Yeah, that's what kind of happened to it. I think that was sort of what was like. Maybe it became too many things.
I think Studio 60. I think the idea of it was admirable. Like,
yes.
It's an interesting idea, but I think. It's difficult to put the kind of weight. Not that when you work in the entertainment business, of course you put a lot of weight on your job.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to put the kind of social weight, the gravity, onto a sketch comedy show that the White House has.
It is. I think it's, and they had so many amazing people there, and I think tonally it just missed a bit in terms of like, are we looking at this realistically? Like,
right?
And
yeah.
How did we end up in Afghanistan? I mean, and there's so many. I mean, you could make a whole show about, someone is too coked up backstage to go on live. And I mean, I'd want to watch that. I mean, that book, the Saturday Night Live book is like, and of course they all knew the book. So it wasn't like Aaron Sorkin wasn't familiar. I think he hung out at SNL.
Yeah.
But I think there is a lot of high stakes at SNL, but I think maybe in his mind, the global, there's nothing that can beat global stakes.
Well, I think one of the problems with it was that, 30 Rock started around the same time, and 30 Rock was, a same premise of like the behind the scenes of a sketch comedy show, but it was so silly.
Right.
And it's kind of like, and they, every time they would talk about the weight of a sketch, they did it for comedic effect.
Yeah.
And it just kind of showed, it was just like, I think they were just too close together.
Yeah.
If they had come out at different times, I think it would have been fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It was,
And besides, the truth of what happens on shows like that is probably better than what you could fictionalize.
Well, exactly.
Like, you want to see the documentary of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can thank James Franco for that. There is a – he made the SNL
He did?
He did.
Yeah, I think, but it was just like a week in SNL, right?
Yeah, but then he actually did get a lot of people to kind of come and do interviews, like from cast members.
Oh, fuck, I didn't know that. I thought it was just,
of course he did, that artistic motherfucker.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
How dare
he? Who's going to say no to him?
Have a perfect idea.
Yeah. He's got a ton of them.
Damn it.
Yeah, he's. I'm sure he's quoting Rimbaud throughout the documentary. grabbing his balls.
Everyone just thinks he's saying Rambo.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's like Rimbo First Blood.
That's the trick. He's been talking about pop culture stuff the entire time, but saying it differently.
Did you ever audition for that, for SNL, for sketch?
Well, you know what's funny is we're sitting. I won't reveal our location. I don't know if I'm allowed to. But
yes, you can.
Okay, I don't know where we are, but it's somewhere in Hollywood. No, I know exactly where we are because we're across from where I shot Mad TV.
Right.
Which was, so I always wanted to be on SNL, like many people do. And I, at 19, I dropped out of college, and I started auditioning, and it was like, I got a lot of things going, kind of, that didn't pan out, some did, but it was like this sort of like storm of stuff happening. And I ended up, an audition came up, I think a couple years later for Mad TV, and I was like, well, geez, you know, I really want to do SNL. But at that point, there were no openings. And I had heard you can never do SNL if you do Mad TV. And I had never seen Mad TV, but they were like, they really want you to come in. And I thought that, you know, everyone kept saying I was too young for all this stuff because I was like 21 or 22. And they're like, they don't hire anybody that age and you're too young and you're too young, but just go in. And I auditioned for Mad TV. They all said I was too young, apparently, except the head of Fox at that time. And she was like, you need to hire him. And they hired me, and it was the worst experience.
Oh, no.
And it was this lot. It's like a terrible,
no.
Well, I had never seen the show. And then I did see it, and then I was scared that I had to go onto it. And there were so many fabulous, wonderful, people on it, really funny people, but it was kind of a train wreck of a show, I think. And there really were like incredibly talented performers, incredibly talented writers who also, a lot of them were performers and people that I had grown up watching, but it didn't have any cohesion, and it wasn't, you know, the taste level was, it just wasn't in the same voice, I guess, that I wanted to speak in. And I got buried there because they didn't want me, but the network wanted me, and I came in late in the game, and other people, it was like I was sort of in the middle of the season, and I just got squashed. It was and I did 7 episodes, and it was horrible. But like I guess at that moment I thought, well, then I felt like that was the end of my desire to do, and I had been doing sketch stuff out here for years, like 5-6 years, doing Second City and doing a lot of live stuff. So I was like, and I was done. That was it. I was like, well, if SNL, if this is the model for, and I had read the SNL book, and I read the SNL book in my trailer here on this lot while doing Mad TV, and I cried. Really did. And I was just
sweet irony.
Yeah, because I hated being on the show. Like I would pitch these ideas. If people would listen, which was hard sometimes even to get that, because, you know, it's such a political thing, and it's a frat house thing, and it's like, and I was late, and people didn't, but I started to kind of get heard, and then I actually started to get some sketches into the packet, which was huge, and then we would read them, and it would kill, and they, like you hear in SNL, and then they just wouldn't pick them, or whatever, or you'd shoot something, and it would destroy, and they wouldn't air it, and it was like, I just didn't understand it. And I was like, well, this is probably a fraction of what happens at SNL. And I was done. Like, I just didn't want to. And then the next year, of course, was sort of the moment I could have gone to audition. And it was like the year they hired everyone, like Bill and Andy those people. And I was shooting actually Derek and Simon, which I remember hanging out around.
Yeah.
And with Bob Odenkirk, and Bernie Brillstein was like, do you want to do the SNL thing? You have to, I just need you to tell me now, would you be willing to move to New York? You know, I was about to get married, and it was like, you know, you've got a fiance. And I said, and I just pictured it, and I was like, no, I'm not saying I would have gotten on, but like, but I'll always sort of be bummed in my heart that I didn't kind of, the timing wasn't a little different, or that
Bill had a very similar, like, the same thing. He was like, he had met Maggie, and like he kind of just started getting work. He had the part on Derek and Simon pilot.
Yeah, and
stuff,
that was when he auditioned.
Yeah,
he auditioned during the shooting of that, and he left, and then he came back, and he had gotten it. And I was like, I just, my brain was spin. I mean, I was like, wait a minute. So that's like you really, like, I was so happy for him, but I was also so torn inside about like that fate and going out there. And, but it, I just got so beaten down by it here. And I also felt like, you know, I was burnt. I don't know, sketch. I was burnt out. I mean, 5 years of doing it out here, and you want to tell like longer stories, I guess. And
sketch is tough because there are not a lot of outlets to do sketch, and sketch isn't really like stand up can be an end result. Like, I'm going to be a stand up,
right?
But it's difficult to just say I'm just going to be a sketch actor because it's difficult to tour with it. There's almost zero places on television where you can just be a sketch comedian.
And it never works on TV, ever.
It's tough.
I mean, whenever you hear there's a new variety show, and, I mean, you know, there's a handful of, obviously, the iconic, fantastic sketch comedy shows, but whenever you hear about it now, it's like, it's just rare. It's like, I feel like it's even harder to have a great sketch show than it is to find a great new sitcom or drama.
Yeah,
it's
like one in a million. People should do it because they love it, or do it because it trains them to understand how to pick up character really fast.
But you have to kind of, it's like, you know, with the idea of Key and Peele, like, they had to make it the most cinematic sketch show ever for it to,
but
like,
they're
actually
great.
Make
like, they have such a clear voice and an idea of what they want to do.
It's not a bunch of, a bunch of random people being plugged into a team.
Exactly.
And that's like when SNL, I mean, I think when it works, I think it's somewhat random because it is this chemistry thing that happens because they are plucking them out, you know. I mean, unless some of them, the ones that I think that work best from the beginning are the ones where these people have been, you know, they've been working together at the Groundlings or Second City or whatever, if they have some earlier kind of a history of performing together, because that it is about the ensemble. And I don't know, I just, the Mad TV thing, I mean, there were so many things wrong with it, but that was, it was, I don't know, the politics of it. I guess there is a game you have to play, particularly SNL. And
but there must be also, I mean, but on every show there is a tightrope to walk a little bit, you know, especially, you know, especially on your show now, because obviously everything worked out okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, because everyone's goals, I think it's difficult for everyone to have personal goals, but then still, as you grow, make sure that your personal goals can complement or be congruent with the rest of the team's goals.
Yeah.
And then I think that's, you know, when that doesn't happen, I think that's where you see a lot of like, oh, this one person decided to quit, and then there was fighting between these two, and then that guy did this, and they didn't, you know, like, he started getting more of these storylines.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it got I don't know what it would be like on another show. On ours, it feels very, I mean, we're actors for hire. We don't write the show. We don't contribute creatively beyond our performances and our characters, and which is, you know, a lot, but we don't come in with, we're not writing or pitching things. We're there to have these great writers supply us with great stories and dialogue, and then we all go out there and listen to each other and show up on time, and that's it. I mean, and so I think, like, it sounds somewhat simple, but I mean, there's drama here and there, but I haven't seen anything affect somebody, the amount of screen time. I never hear, oh, my screen time is this, or I'm never being, because I, you know, gave a look to this person, I was not in the last episode as much, or that it doesn't. Saturday Night Live is like, you know, you're like an independent contractor that does everything, you know, and it's like, you don't write for yourself, like, you don't get on. You do write for yourself, you might also not get on. And like, and there are these politics. Well, you want to write with the writer who has the most, who's most popular right now with Lauren, or you want to be in the, you want to write a sketch with the performer who's most popular with, or the person who, you know, has a movie out now, because you know they're going to be able to get more. It's like, it really, and I don't judge anyone for that, because I get that thing. I don't love playing that game. And luckily on Big Bang, I mean, I'm sure if I like shit in Chuck's mailbox or something, he would be like, well,
first of all, that would be an amazing feat.
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen probably already did it.
I'm not gonna say,
are you shitting and then putting it in there, or are you actually shitting into the mailbox?
I can no longer confirm or deny whether I said that already.
Well, I can say that I know all of you in the cast to varying degrees, and everyone that I know is lovely. Like, yeah, I, you know, Kunal and I work on a cartoon together.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
He, you know, and he's, you know, whenever I see him, he's just, he's so warm and yeah. sweet. And I've known Galecki for, since yeah. we were teenagers. Oh, wow. I mean, like, it's, everyone's yeah. just, you know.
It's a really nice, yeah, it really is, it's pretty special. And I mean, I think that that contributes also to the success is just the, I don't know, there really is like a kind of ineffable quality of, where you just, we all understand what the story we're telling is. Like, we just do. We, and whether that's literally the story in the show or just why we're all here, why we're doing it, and we all listen, we all, there's no confusion about, I guess, our role. You know, again, I don't just mean character, but just like on the set.
Was that pretty immediate when you guys started? Did you feel like a connection with everybody?
Yeah, I think it was like, you know, I mean, I definitely, like I was saying earlier, like I had shot so many pilots and it was, you know, and you always hear like, oh, as soon as you stop caring, that's when it'll get picked up. And you can't force yourself to not care. And it would be awesome. Like I said also earlier, if I could just be an indifferent human, I'd be so happy. But I did finally kind of give in to, well, hey, if I can make a pilot a year, I can live off that, and it doesn't matter what happens to it. And we shot the pilot, and I kind of thought I had that, you know, I that was what I was thinking. I was like, well, I'll just shoot this, and I can live. And but I did, when we were doing it, think this is something a bit different than I've experienced. The audience is way more enthusiastic about these characters. They don't know them yet. I don't know why they're applauding when we enter, because they haven't met us yet. You know, there was stuff like that happening. It was really bizarre. And, excuse me, but I didn't, and the whole, I guess, geek culture thing, which I'm sure you can speak to. Well, I didn't know anything about that.
Even though you were playing these characters.
Yeah. I mean, I familiarized myself enough with what I could about that, but I don't, I mean, I and obviously the culture existed, probably, maybe not on as I don't know, a ubiquitous a platform as it does now. Probably partially because of the show and you and everything that's kind of going on. But like, I just, you know, I was like, oh, these are, I didn't realize how real these people were and how much they meant to those people, like the people that were these guys. Lived kind of quietly waiting for someone to represent them.
Because the show can be a little polarizing within geek culture, because one segment of it is like, I identify with these characters, and another segment is like, we're not all like that. You know what I mean? Like, you sort of get that. You sort of get the two.
Yeah, the initial, of course, like out of the gates, people, as they love to do, just rip you apart. Like, and that was like crazy. I didn't, you know, again, it's like people are so ready to just, I don't know.
To rip your fucking head off.
I just don't get it. I just constantly.
I'm just a guy. Yeah. I'm on a show. Please, you would do it. You would do it.
Yeah, that is, it is the feeling. It's like, like I, you know, like I made a movie or I made a show. Like I didn't babysit your kid and then abandon him in a parking lot to go get drunk. Like, why are you so mad? Didn't, you know, like
didn't abandon the kid in the parking lot and scrawl "fuck nerds" across the top.
Yeah, like the interview, the movie is gonna start a world war. Like, I mean, then okay, maybe I understand. You might say like, "Hey, let's look at some content. What are we doing here, guys? Like, what's happening here?" But like, this, we just made this TV show. It was a pilot, and they ripped us down into our faces. I guess I give them credit for that. It was before Twitter, but they ripped us down, ripped us apart at this TCA panel, and it was like, are you going to have an original thought? Is everything going to be so sexist? Are you just going to keep copying old ideas? Are you gonna make fun of nerds? Don't you think bullying is? I mean, it was like,
hey
guys, it's a pilot. It's a sitcom, and it's 20 minutes long. Can you give us another 20 minutes to maybe find ourselves, and then maybe another 20 after that, like. You guys, like, cool out. It doesn't – everybody is so nuts to bring I guess, you know, I guess if you have a lot of pent-up hostility and you sit and your job is to be critical, I guess you probably just wait to be unleashed, because you got – all you've got is this one-way channel, this megaphone, and so you don't have a dialogue. You have you just yell, and then
You're the face. You see people do that. It's like you have no. You're not writing the show. You're not casting the show. It's like I saw the same thing happen at a Silicon Valley panel where it's like it's just the cast, just the guys. And then like people are going, why aren't there more female programmers in the show? And they're like, well, we don't know.
And you get it, and you get it positively too. They're like, hey, are you ever gonna have kids? Like, are you ever gonna sleep? And they're like, I have kids. My character doesn't have kids, and I don't know if I'm ever gonna have kids because we're not real. And I don't write the show, and I don't. I mean, I'm not mean to them, but I, you know, to fans, and I understand. And actually, it's probably a good thing that, or a good sign, I should say, that people connect with these characters in such a real way that they do come up to you and say, like, you know, like in Star Trek Season 3, I'm like, this is gonna hurt your feelings, but like, I haven't seen Star Trek. I know that's crazy, and I mean, I've watched enough. From doing the show that what I need to understand, but I'm not a Trekkie. I'm sorry.
You know what else I found out? It turns out that Tom Selleck was not actually a private investigator.
No, that's ridiculous. He was. That's why they gave him the job.
Jonah, no. I know this is close to you because it took place in Hawaii. But,
yeah, down the street.
But the mustache was real, right?
Yes. Okay. That was real. He just grew it for the part.
But
Well, I think it's when...
He grew it because of the 70s.
It's when people, it's when people front-load... questions with how they want their agenda to be expressed as opposed to just saying, hey, do you think X? They'll go, how come X is this way? And you're like, well, first of all, we have not established that that's the case.
Yeah.
Let's have a conversation instead of...
Right.
And you as the face, people, you know, you are... It's sort of like, you're not just a performer on a show. I've learned you're also a customer service representative.
Yeah.
It's like you know, customer service representative... didn't make the rules. They're not the boss.
Right.
They're the person you yell at when your thing didn't work.
Yeah.
And so, because they're the only inroad that you have. And so, like,
they should stop lying. Their names are not Bob. Bobs don't have access. I'm sorry.
Not Bob.
If they would just be honest, we would treat them better.
I mean, come on. But I think it's, you know, like, it's the reason why I get tweets from people who go, your lighting is dumb. Like, okay, I'll, I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, there's a hostility. I mean, I think it does come, well, sometimes it comes from a place of love and like want and feeling like, this is a world that you've invited them into and you're letting them down with your lighting and they don't understand that you probably aren't up on a ladder, you know, with the gaffer and that they don't know what a gaffer is. And I barely do too, but it sounds like really cool. But I do get it, but you know, I don't know. It's constantly the feeling of letting people down is like, and the social media thing, I mean, my God. And the more I'm out there, like, I've been promoting this movie, and it's like, the more I'm out there, the more the movie's out there, the more, it's like, people just can't wait to tell you exactly where you've gone wrong and how you could fix it.
Well, I think the problem, you know, what happens is just when people watch television, when they watch whatever they're watching, whatever visual medium they're watching, they are seeing you two-dimensionally.
Yeah.
And I think... So they emotionally assign that as like they forget you're a three-dimensional person and maybe you don't control everything. And hey, you know, maybe you're a nice guy that took a job and this is your job. And you know, like you don't pull all the strings.
And I think when someone's, you know, critiquing something or leaving a comment or having, it's like, I don't think they feel interesting if they have something positive to say. I think that's maybe the cultural thing.
Well, it's also, you know, what is the quickest way to affect somebody? It's to hurt them and to that. I think what these people who do troll on comment boards or on Twitter to you know, leave negative or nasty things, like, they, it would make their day to know that the person, the celebrity, the person that they look up to actually noticed them. The negative part of it is secondary. I think it's just, what's the quickest way to be seen by? And it's the same thing when I meet people. It's like, apparently nobody watches my show because everybody that comes up to me, it's a relative of theirs that watches it, or it's their second cousin or their wife, and they always undercut the compliment. And it's like, they'll be like, listen, I saw I don't get your show. I mean, I saw part of it. I never really. My wife, it's actually her brother is the biggest. It would mean the world to me if I could get a picture with you just from my wife's brother, my brother-in-law. And I'm like, well, wait, so how do you like, well, I mean, I look, it grew on me, but and I'm like, all right. Or like someone will come up like, I hated your show so much when it first started, but I was trapped in Honduras in an internment camp.
And it was the only connection to the outside world.
They offered anal feeding or your show, and I chose anal feeding, but there's at a certain point, you know, you're full. And I'm like, uh-huh. Anyway, could I get a selfie? And you're like, fuck. That's
well, I think, you know, I think
it humanizes.
Yes, and I think there's a common misconception that, you know, that we as performers can't take criticism, and I always say, like, it's not that we can't take criticism, just don't front load it with aggression.
Right.
If you know, if you have a concern, like when we first started at Midnight, you know, not for any reason that any of us were conscious of, you know, the female comic always ended up in the middle.
Okay.
For some reason, it wasn't conscious. It was just and a couple of people were like, fuck you, you're always putting the woman. And they're like, but the couple of people that said, hey, I was just wondering, you know, is there a reason that you're doing that? It feels intentional or it feels weird, you know? Have you thought about that?
Yeah.
That's much more
like, we like woman sandwiches. Yeah. It's very intentional.
I would say, so that made me go, oh, you know what? Okay, you're coming at me from a reasonable place.
What was the critique of that?
Well, I think it's just...
Is the middle like a lesser...
It's not at all.
Was it Jezebel who said
it? It was not. It was just the idea that it was always the same.
Okay.
In the beginning, it was always the same. And it sort of felt like, well, at a certain point, it starts to feel intentional. And is there a reason that you're doing that and not... And there wasn't a reason, but, you know, because it was, you know, a criticism that at a certain point was... presented to me reasonably, and I really thought about it. And I was like, well, you know, there's no reason, but yeah, we shouldn't do that. Right. We should mix it up. You're right. I mean, like, I welcome polite, constructive conversation about, you know, because I don't always know what's right. And maybe sometimes I'm coming across in a way that I don't intend to. So
sure.
I'm perfectly willing to examine that.
Exactly.
But when people start firing arrows, you're not going to open your arms and let 50 arrows sink into your chest. You're going to tighten up and get behind armor and get defensive.
Right. And also, I guess, to what end? You know, what is the point? What do you want? What is the criticism? Is it to be snarky? Is it to be...
And that's
heard.
When it becomes more. And
it is.
This
to
isn't
be
just
heard.
For. This is. We all do this. But when your criticism is an attack, a lot of times it's actually more about you,
sure,
than it is the thing you're quote unquote trying to criticize.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Because if you really are interested in change, then you will try to understand first and have a conversation and go.
Yeah.
Hey, have you thought that this might be coming up this way? Oh my gosh, no, I haven't.
Right.
I agree or I don't agree.
But that's the thing, is none of these platforms, social media, or comment, it's not a dialogue. That's what I think appeals to scared people who are hiding and kind of shooting out these arrows. Or it isn't. It's like that Louis C.K. thing, how he said, you know, remember when you were a bully, how you used to actually have to get up and then you go into the person in front of their face and then you say something mean and then you might get hit in the face
because
you said the mean thing but that was something you were willing to risk because that's how much you wanted to be, you know, and that is so true. You don't have to do anything anymore to be the bully except sit there and, you know, and look, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of wonderful supportive people, but it is an interesting thing. And I feel like it's a little toxic, you know, to hang out online on those. And, you know, I don't know. I've kind of tried to pull myself off of that just because I'm also really not that interested in, you know, I don't know who those people are or what their agenda is. I guess I'm totally interested in like somebody I admire or respect telling me their opinion, but and they have the right to express their opinion, but you can't help but get a little hurt. It's like if you walk down the street and a crazy vagabond comes up and, you know, says like, fuck you, you tiny dick motherfucker. And you're like, well, first of all, maybe I should wear some clothes. And but you're
so
like,
my bad that
but you're like,
there.
Well, that hurts a little bit. I don't know why. I don't know that person, but it doesn't, it doesn't feel nice, I guess, to have some arrows.
I got bent out of shape the other day because someone was saying that a friend of mine got cast in a movie and someone was like, that person sucks and they don't deserve to have that role. And I was like, and I got really defensive about it. I'm like, who the fuck are you to say what that person deserves?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I know that person. They've worked very hard. What have you done? Like, you know, you can say, and they were like, well, just expressing my opinion. I go, no, no, no. Your opinion is I don't like that person. You cannot say, you don't have the right to say what someone else deserves.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I totally got sucked in to the point where I had to like back away and go, okay, well now I'm being petty. Now I am word dissecting and I am doing the exact thing that I tell other people not to do. And in the end, we sort of politely agreed to disagree because it just didn't, it just wasn't going to a good place.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remember when you have an exchange with someone, what is your goal?
Yeah.
Your goal should always be to understand, and if the understanding that you reach is we just disagree, that's okay.
Right.
The other person isn't worse than Hitler because they don't share your opinion on a pop culture thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Worse than Hitler, though, would be a great pop song, speaking
of. or name for a band.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an awesome...
But is it... Has... You still seem totally fine and normal to me... But success is very, you know, like success, particularly in this town, can be very dangerous. Like it can, because it can be somewhat poisonous to people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, I don't know, I've watched people like go from not being successful to being successful and like known them sort of throughout those stages. And I mean, what I've found is that it kind of only exacerbates what you are. I mean, if you're a kind person, I think it actually kind of opens your heart a little more. And if you're a shitty person, then you kind of get shittier, I think. I don't think that you start, you know, one way and then end up, you know, start as a lovely, you know, sensitive, giving soul and then become, you know, a toxic, black-hearted, evil snake. You know, I think that you're sort of... It's just an exaggerated, it kind of feeds whatever you are to begin with. That's been my experience. I mean, and I've seen both. I've seen kind of awful people get a little more awful, but I don't know. That's at least what I've seen. I'm sure there are examples of, you know, different cases, but I don't know. So for me, that's why I'm such an awful person now. I've always been this way.
Well, I think maybe you slogged it out for so long, you know, to finally get to the place where you don't have to fight so hard.
Yeah.
I think it's like it kind of, you go, oh, now I can actually enjoy this.
Yeah.
Like kind of like John Hamm, like, you know, he was just like, you know,
I'm
just
often compared to him.
Yes. Like just, but like, you know, working actor for a long time, you were a working actor, but like, you know, work and fame are different things. And,
right.
And so, yeah, that's what I think you kind of have more in perspective when it comes to.
Yeah, you should, I think. And I mean, yeah, it's definitely, I'm grateful for this, and I don't feel different, but I'm sure I'm a little bit different, I guess.
Well, number one, you're wearing a diamond jumpsuit.
Well, yeah. I always had the jumpsuit. The diamonds did come later, but that's
before it was cubic zirconium.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it depends on, you know, where people are placing their identity, and if you're placing your identity in real life things,
yeah.
Then you're a little more protected, as because you can't control the ebb and flow of it's something as tumultuous as any business, particularly the entertainment business. But if you place your identity in success or in money or in anything that's external to like that type of external, you can't control that, and so you're always going to be like, you're always going to be trying to protect that because that's your identity, you
right?
know? And if it's not your identity, then it's like, well, this is great for now. Yeah. Didn't work before. May not work again in a few years. Don't know. Just hope it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, and I do think, like, I also, some of the people that I know that have become famous that I knew, like, before they were, like, in high school and stuff, kind of, like, people that became famous really quickly, kind of always acted like they were famous, too. And I, like, there was a degree, and I think in some way they manifested it. I mean, talented as well and driven and connected or whatever the case may be. But like, I don't know, there's something about, I think there is something about where you put your focus and some of those people, if you want to be famous, it's not that insanely hard just to be famous these days. If that is your primary goal, regardless of how you get there, you know, I mean, yeah, the internet is a way to make yourself do something, you know, crazy, I guess, but or get a reality show or, you know, whatever it is. I'm not saying that's easy, but I mean, whatever it may be. But I think, yeah, your priorities are, they probably don't shift that much depending on, you know, the level of success.
I do think, though, that, you know, because things are going so well, I think you should start doing fun, deranged millionaire type of things where you, like, buy a town and everything has to be green, or you you set aside $1 million to research how to genetically engineer, like, motorized pigs, or just, like, some weird... I think you do have a responsibility...
to be the eccentric.
Just set aside, like, you know, be responsible with your investments, you know, because you never know what's going to happen in the future. Make sure your family is taken care of. Make sure, you know, like, charity... But then set aside, like, a crazy...
I'm trying to grow an anatomically correct ear on my back, because I think it will enhance the hearing. You know, it may be
that's what I want to hear from you. How many times when you were a kid, you're like, man, if I had, I would do that. Like, you just need to do one of those.
Yeah, it's
true. Do one of those.
I know. I haven't figured it out yet. I'm a bad successful person.
We're gonna teach sharks how to communicate through sign language.
Yeah.
No.
Wait a minute.
First, the hands. The hands. That's right.
Yeah.
We're going to give them
that's
hands.
Another guy doing that.
Yeah.
Because what a great story is if you got absorbed with that and then you became like an evil genius. And
right.
And it's like, I mean, like, what an amazing.
Like the first action, like legitimate evil genius.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. After Big Bang, there's a lot more sharks out there and they can use chopsticks. Yeah. They're taking
over. Of course, they're eating sushi.
Which is killing the rest of the marine life.
Yeah. Now
we didn't think the fish were going to go this way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's actually the sharks that killed out the entire fish population.
Yeah, exactly. Because they could grab more while eating others.
Yeah.
You know?
They said it was going to be global warming. They never predicted sharks with chopsticks.
And they're just punching out dolphins.
Exactly.
Breaking the horns off a narwhal.
Yeah.
God damn it. A shark with hands is a terrifying thought.
Really gentle hands.
Too. Really soft.
Soft hand model shark. I don't use my hands for aggressive acts.
And then that takes us back to SNL, Landshark.
Yes. Oh,
Landshark.
Yeah.
God damn it, Landshark.
Yeah.
Not all that first couple of seasons really holds up.
No,
it doesn't. I know,
but
it's so
some
funny
of them, the ones that did.
So did those seasons at the time? I mean, okay, because it was a groundbreaking. I mean, the culture and where people were at, and the what that was and what that represented to people. Obviously, it was this. You know, it blew the roof off of.
I mean, you know,
but at that. So has it aged? Not necessarily as well, or is it, what is it?
The culture has moved past.
I think the problem, I think that it's not really the same playing field anymore.
Right.
Because, you know, at the time, you know, in the mid-70s, you're coming out of the golden age of television where there's this very idealized version of people and families and comedy and everything super... Everything's great, you know.
Right,
it's just that post-war era, like,
so
you know,
like the rock and roll,
the Texaco attendants with the bow ties, and
then
you know,
these anarchists show up, and the comedy scene.
And then comedy in the '70s sort of rebelled against like the Bewitched era and the Partridge Family era and the Brady Bunch era, where it was like, you know, then you had Norman Lear and you had All in the Family and Mary Tyler Moore and all these shows that. Where the comedy was based a little more, and this is how people are kind of shitty,
right?
And this is how they are, and this is a little more real, And you know, an SNL was a show that basically was as gritty as you could. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of stuff they did on SNL in the first couple seasons would probably not be allowed on television now.
Right, that might be true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it was more that they were.
The voice of the generation.
Of that generation and breaking the mold. It was more punk rock. It was it was more kind of unstructured in the way that punk rock is, because it's more of a statement than it was like super tight comedy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think it was important
for
that
reason.
So
you look at it now and it's like, well, they've had, you know, 40 years to develop.
Right,
this kind of.
And also, like, you know, what is it rebelling against now?
Yeah, it doesn't
really.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, it's an. It, I don't know. It's an interesting thing.
I mean, can a punk band can be a punk band for 40 years? You know, like they would have to sort of evolve, right? We, you yeah. could probably speak to that. They, Kyle, yeah. being the huge punk fan that you are, like, is it can a punk band always be a punk band, or at a certain point do they become like a part of the system?
I think it depends on how much you hold to like what you were standing for originally. Your original idea is just I'm young and snotty and rebelling. That. Can't sustain. Although some bands have it, like a band like the Dickies, and they have
yeah.
it because they're just old dudes who are still 14-year-old boys.
That's great.
But I think that there's also bands who can evolve who bring thought to it. Like a band like Crass, to me, have sort of sustained, and the work that they've done, the things they influence, still maintain an influence over time. So I think you can do it. It depends on what your ideology is and what your final goal is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just, you know, whenever you see John Lydon acting up, you're like, what's he mad about?
Yeah.
He's always kind of a poser. And yeah. at the same time, like, evolved in an interesting way. And I feel like the Sex Pistols are a band I have such a problematic relationship with because they were never that great to begin with.
P.I.L. is way better
P.I.L. is exactly what I was going with, which are Pistols. Punk as fuck because they're doing all sorts of things, exploring humanity and depression in all these different interesting ways in weird musical ways that were way more out there than, like, just playing, like, dirty 50s music, like which is what all the Sex Pistols were.
Yeah.
Right. Interesting. That took an interesting dovetail into the history and
evolution. Yeah, and as you get older, when you have kidney stones, it's harder to piss on the stage.
But it makes for some better screaming.
This is the worst pain. And I jammed a screwdriver into my forearm.
Can someone get me a medic? But you said anarchy. Okay, I know, but in this instance, I feel like we need some institutionalized medicine because my dick hurts.
Good news, my earlobes are longer than they used to be, so just jam the safety pin in. It'll be much easier now, I promise.
Yeah, if you want to get to the kidneys, you just have to move my balls out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a show I would love.
Just like I think it's an interesting. I think it'd be an interesting show. Is you know, like can a punk band, you know, like go back out on the road and still be punk? Is it can they be punk to a younger generation, or is it nostalgic, or are their old fans?
Well, because isn't it the timing is all. I mean, exactly. It's what you're rebelling against, so it's gonna change by the minute, right?
I mean,
it's mm-hmm. not. I mean, that would, I guess, yeah, you, I mean, you're, you know way more about everything you just said. I heard nothing. I heard, it was very punk. You were rebelling against my interview here. I didn't know what you were talking about. I guess there are bands that can.
But there are some, like, who's the Irish guy with no teeth?
Isn't that all of them?
Shane McGowan, yes.
Yeah. I feel like that's a lot
Shane McGowan will always be punk as fuck.
Yeah,
definitely. Because he doesn't, because... It's, you know.
He put teeth in.
He did?
No, he didn't. That would really kill the effect.
That might kill the effect if he put teeth in. But I think, you know, becoming part of the system, because at a certain point, well, first of all, you rebel against the system because you're not part of the system. You know, like you either hate the system or the system rejected you, so you rebel against it.
Right.
But then at a certain point, you know, the system is comfortable.
Well, yeah. Well, then you can eat food.
And comfort, you know, like as human beings, we're drawn to comfort. And once you're comfortable, it's like, I'm not so mad anymore.
But
I feel good.
But I think that tears people apart. You know, that's like, because if you're anti-establishment, but then the establishment likes that message and takes you on and then sponsors you to be anti-establishment, it becomes like this crossroads of, well, I can kind of do the same thing and... I can maybe buy a car as well. Yeah.
Get the word out.
Exactly. And have more people maybe, you know, tune into this thing. But then I guess I'm technically not, you know, shouting the same message I was before. Does that change? Who am I then in doing this?
Yeah, there's a Black Mirror episode about that.
Wait, which one?
It's the one where it said they're all like riding the bikes. Episode 2, season 1, some of them. It's like, yeah, yes. Like he's on that American
Idol
kind
of
show.
The American Idol.
You just reminded me that I have to finish watching Black Mirror. I have a weekend off, and Lydia and I are going to watch the fuck out of Black Mirror.
I've only seen actually the first two.
I saw the first one.
Yeah, they're great. I didn't see the Christmas episode. Tomorrow.
What?
No.
BBC
what?
Can work out a deal
it goes tomorrow. Off Netflix tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, my God.
Shit.
We got to go.
God, what are we still doing here?
Wait, I've only seen the first two, but that second one.
Yeah, second one's great. They're all great.
Yeah, well, the second one is exactly what we're talking, and it is it is really done.
This is
so
perfect
well.
Time. You know what? What a Black Mirror episode that I only have a day and a half to try to do whatever I can to watch Black Mirror.
Yeah.
Well, I could always just use Tunnel Bear and make my computer think I'm in the UK and then watch it on some streaming service over
that
there.
Whole time. Yeah, you guys.
It's a proxy server. Really? It's all that?
Yeah. You are punk.
Proxy server. This next one's called Proxy Server. 1, 2, 3.
It's going to be played in a different building.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But it'll be broadcast here. Kyle, I like. It's always. I can tell when I genuinely tickle Kyle, and that was Kyle was genuinely tickled in that moment.
Meaning he knows every time you fake laugh.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This movie that you, at what point in the series did you, was this something you've been kicking around for a while, or did you?
Okay, so I'll give you the brief rundown. So
pretend we're at a junket. Yes. No, don't do that because that'll kill
you. Okay. Well, my wife and I, before we got married, had this catastrophic intercontinental breakup that was like among the most clumsy things I've experienced, and that as I talk to people about it, it seems that maybe anyone's experienced. And it resulted in this disastrous proposal, and it was all really kind of in the matter of like weeks that it happened, and I had started talking to people about this, and they're like, "Oh my god!" Like, I thought I had a terrible engagement story, or I had that breakup thing, but yours, this is the most unbelievable. Like, what kind of self-destructive maniac are you? And I said, "Well, maybe I should write this into some kind of comedy because it was so tragic that I thought it's time to laugh about it." And I wrote this movie, and it's the story of our almost demise, and. I decided after writing it to tell my wife that I was writing a movie about our breakup, which was the
you know how you keep saying you want our life story broadcast to a larger audience?
You know how I made a series of bad decisions? Here's the latest. I wrote a movie about it. That really like basically was what would happen.
If you get mad, I'm just going to write a movie about that.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be a sequel. You want to get divorced? I'll make this a trilogy. It was crazy. You know, I had this kind of like quarter life crisis. I thought I needed to be a man. I thought I should explore other possibilities. And I essentially just like pulled the rug out from this lovely relationship and set it on fire, and then immediately regretted it and tried to put all the pieces back together. Ran back to her, ran to different girls, ran to my friends, confessed that I had feelings, lied to them, lied to her, inadvertently broke up, ran to other girls. It was like this, like a few days of absolute insanity. And then by the time I came back, she had decided she was leaving to Paris, and I said, "Okay, well, I'll follow you there." And I showed up, and I surprised her in Paris.
Then you were arrested.
Effectively, yeah. I used the word surprise. It was more of stalked her, and it was crazy. Now, I don't know how I had the. I think at that age or something. I mean, and I was in love with her, and I had made all these bad mistakes, and I knew it, and I knew. I don't know whether I was like thinking, will this be a romantic comedy someday? Because in the romantic comedy, the guy would fly to Paris. Like, I don't know if I was inspired by romantic comedies or what was leading the way here, but I did all these kind of grand gestures, and I sobbed and groveled and wept my way through every national landmark and Père Lachaise, and really, like, and she had met a Frenchman who played violin, like, in the course of a week.
Oh, that's rough.
It was crazy.
How do you get past that?
You don't. You get put on a plane and drugged and sent back to America. Jesus. And it was, and then she returned, and we were in this, again, this horrible, we were still, like, broken up. I was dry heaving. I mean, it was, like, the craziest time ever, and I decided, you know what would I think what would be a good move here is to propose to her, which is terrible. And I continued to dig my own hole and get in and bury myself. And the proposal was it was the worst proposal of all time. And it was in a car, and I confessed more feelings that I had for other people while we were in this gray area, while we were together. I like basically cleansed my palate of all the guilt I had ever had while proposing to her in like one long horrible
speech.
You're
a terrible person.
It was bad. But the thing was, is I don't think I am that bad of a person.
No.
And that was what I started to kind of realize. Well, I hope that's what I'm telling myself. But I think that people get confused and make bad decisions and tend to do it kind of in these moments where the thing that means most to them is right there, and then they hit the eject button sometimes and, you know, hit their head on the roof and land in Tom
Goose.
Cruise's
You're
arms
about
and
Goose.
Float yeah. out the, into the sea with yeah. a lifeless body. It always comes back to Top Gun for me. But I found a wingman and Mrs. Iceman. So it was crazy. So I wrote the movie, and then my wife and I decided to direct it together, which was crazy, and tell the story of our own unraveling. And
but that makes it a fair and balanced portrayal.
I think it does. Yeah. I mean, it was also somewhat of a strange, like, masochistic decision to go back and relive a lot of these moments in, like, to go to Père Lachaise where I sobbed to her and do that scene again, but with a camera crew and with my wife behind the camera, or to make out with, like, you know, the other girl in our lives, or one of the other girls, and have my wife directing that scene while I'm actually making out with another girl, because it's an actress, while my wife's parents sit behind my wife and watch the scene in which I'm ostensibly cheating on their daughter. It was like a...
And the DP is the Frenchman who plays the violin.
Yes, so, I mean... of course, and he's pleasuring himself. I mean, no, it was...
As
it really...
they want to do.
Yes, twisting his mustache. Ugh. But no, it really was like this, I don't know what, you know, there was something also cathartic about it, I guess, but also sadistic and strange, and maybe my wife was exacting her revenge, because what's better than, like, having someone kind of shit all over you and then going back years later making them relive it on film and getting to criticize
it's
them
like
about their performance in it?
It's like the documentary with the war crime guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Exactly. The one where they write, well, yeah, what yeah. is that called?
What's that called? Kyle.
Well, we got it.
What is that? Act of killing. Act of
right,
killing.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's,
Yeah, they beat us to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Trust me, this is more upsetting. War is...
But, you know, there's two things that are interesting about this. First of all, when the movie comes out, now you really are putting yourself on the line, because if people go, hey, that story sucked, we're like...
Believe me, well, this is partially because it is at this point, it's out. In the last week, it's come out, and it's people can see it, and I should say that it's called We'll Never Have Paris, and we got this amazing cast to play all these strange people, me being the strangest, but we have Zach Quinto, and Melanie Linsky plays...
Oh, she's great.
Yeah, she plays my version, again, they're all versions of us, but a version of my wife. Maggie Grace is in it, Alfred Molina plays my dad, Jason Ritter's in it. It's this, like, incredible group of people, but the crazy part is that I am now, because the whole idea here was, I'm going to show myself in the most humiliating light possible, because that is what I enjoy about this story, and I think about a lot of things.
Did it give you closure on the thing?
I think it certainly, there was a coffin and a nail in it. There were lots of coffins throughout this.
Risky proposition. You're like, your wife could be like, oh yeah, this happened. Fuck you.
There was a lot of, like, there were unspoken things, and, like, I don't know exactly what
agreeing
happened.
On the way that things happen from your two perspectives.
Yeah, that was kind of what was intriguing about it, because, and we didn't share, well, I came close to sharing every detail. That was part of what ended. I was compulsively confessing every impulse and every thought and every detail, like, well, if there was a kiss, was there tongue? Was it, what was it, French or was it Nigerian? What kind of kiss was it? Is there a Nigerian kiss? I'll show it to you.
I learned a lot.
It involves a prince and a lot of lying. But it did open up a lot of areas. It was, I mean, again, it was a risk. The whole thing was vulnerable and scary, and why open up this horrible kind of past that we had? But part of it, I think, was because it felt universal in some way, and it felt funny to me. And what I enjoy, I think the things that I gravitate towards in terms of performing or being a part of are things that kind of are ugly and are humiliating and are kind of, that to me, that is the most vulnerable.
Well, and that's a very human thing too, is being in a situation maybe where something is given to you and it's exactly the thing that you want,
and you get terrified because you're like, am I ready for this? Am I ready for this now? This being the thing? Right. Am I ready for this being the thing? And
or
we're just naturally self-destructive creatures and you know, I couldn't deserve. I mean, or you're just selfish or whatever reason. But those are all human things.
They are. I don't even know what caused all of it. I mean, I think that there is a desire. Yeah, there is a self-destructive kind of gene.
How old were you at the time?
But that's the thing. I mean, I was 24 or something, and I think that's the age
where you do.
Well, that is what you do, yeah. I think, and people sometimes continue to do it, and I guess the thing is that I don't think I didn't do anything that unbelievably wretched throughout this. I got confused, and I kind of made everybody suffer while I told them all of the details of my confusion, and I did affect people. I did, you know, hurt people, and I did. Hurt myself, but I was also very. It was a very solipsistic time. It was all about you. Kind of like at that age too, you tend to look at yourself in the third person a little bit. You're like, this is crazy. I mean, my whole life, I'm risking my whole life. Wow. And you kind of. It's almost like you look at yourself in the mirror while you're crying, and you're like, wow, look at that guy go. That guy's got a lot of emotions. It's sort of like that's like that moment. It sort of feels like that, and so I wanted to show that. It's not appealing. It's not attractive. Like, I didn't... And so we made the movie, and people have really responded incredibly positively to it and related, and people have been moved, and people have thought it was hilarious, and people have also been like, what a dick that guy is, you know? And so then for me, obviously, personally... It hurts because it is a version of mine. I mean, and the movie is a bit of a departure at this point. It's like, you know, it's kind of half fiction, half reality because I wanted to make a good movie more than make an indulgent documentary. But people have these reactions and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, whatever you may think, but I wanted to show a guy in a less than favorable light. This is what I went through. I think people go through this. I think maybe they don't want to admit that they do, or maybe this is a hyper... exaggerated version for some people that I don't know. For me, it's kind of what happened. And then when I tell the story, like, it's a funny story and it's a crazy.
You
thing.
Got through
and
it. Everything worked out.
You got through
fine.
It. And the movie, I think, is really dangerously honest for me. And it's like in a romantic comedy, I think, you know, sometimes you follow the jilted person and they get dumped in the beginning and you go with them on their journey as they kind of get revenge on that guy and find the new guy or whatever. And then this one, you sort of follow the jilter. And that's me. And that was the guy who was like, oh shit, we're done. I think I like that. No, wait, I want you. Hold on. I need some time. Like, hey, you know, and it's just, it's a bit neurotic and crazy. And, yeah, so out of it came something that I think is really special, and I think that the more I've talked to people, the more I'm like, hey, most people didn't have that perfect proposal.
Also, you know, you got to go through stuff like that because it makes you appreciate something really good when you have it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, right, the last time I did something stupid, this happened, so this time I'm going to make a good choice.
Yeah.
And not, you know, like that's how we learn. We learn from doing dumb shit.
Yeah, and we all do that. I don't, you know, and I don't know, you know, I feel like I almost figured out why I did what I did, and I had many versions throughout it, and I just don't know.
I think that you were 24.
I think it is. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's that. I really do think some of it has to do seriously with control, you know, like because you pick... I'm going to marry this person. And then you kind of immediately start thinking about death because you see the end of your life too in that same sentence. And then you're like, okay, no. You're not going to take me to the grave. And then you're like, hold on a second. If I can burn the village down, I can prove that I always had control here because I can then put it back together and say like, see, I did, you know, and I think it is, it's that, because we don't have control over anything, and, you know, hence, you know, OCD and lots of weird disorders that come out of this desire to try to find some grounding here. And it's like, I think there is collateral damage, and sometimes they're the people you love. And
and everything you said, I 100% agree with in terms of like trying to give ourselves a sense of control. I think it's why we do a lot of most of our ritualistic behavior is just like what you said. I also do think 24, 25 is when you first start peering down the runway of your life. When, you know, it's like 16, I'm going to drive. 18, I can vote. So I can drink. I'm 21. Yeah. Woo, 20, college, I'm not. I'm 20, 22.
Yeah.
What do I do? What do I do? Yeah. And then you're 25, and then you're like, there's no right. more real like,
happy birthday. Whatever, you know.
Yeah,
the rest.
Yeah. You guys, we've been there. We've been there. Done this 25 yeah, yeah. times. You know how this is. Yeah. And then you really start to feel like, oh fuck, is this it? Am yeah. I doing the right thing? And I don't know. I'm
like, for me, it was a big thing. Like, am I a man? I don't know. That was like because it was like, do I know how to? You know, I'm small. Like, I can't reach high up on these shelves. What do I do if I can't?
Oh, then no.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. What if I can't open that jar of pasta sauce? Like, seriously, what if I'm at home with my wife? And she's like, can you open this? And I'm like, sure. Yeah, no, wait. Oh, my God. I've been trying to open this jar for 3 hours.
That's all right. I'll get Pierre. He's playing violin. Yeah. Yeah, you need my help. Yeah. Come open the jar again. Yeah. Ah.
Heel, you just
oh, Simon.
Yeah. Rub my boo onto here. Yeah. No, but I mean, it's like, what do I don't know. Like, there were just these things where I guess in my brain I was like, am I a man? Have I been with enough people? Do I know what is out there? Do I know what I am?
How much do you think of that as societal, and how much do you think is biological?
I think both, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, in some ways, like, we're not really built necessarily physiologically to be monogamous in some, you know, although I've heard that prairie dogs are monogamous. They are. They're also fucking prairie dogs. So, I mean, they don't have that. The field is pretty limited for them.
Flat and full of holes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But hey, if I had a field flat and full of holes, I would never leave the house.
I want to throw something at you, Jonah, because I
laughed at you.
No, I saw
so
you
mad.
Cringe because I made the literal joke about prairie dogs.
I liked it.
You did not.
You get so mad when I appreciate a joke.
You don't have
laughing.
To appreciate all of them. Oh it was God. Just
I
the cringe.
It. Now I'm embarrassed.
I saw
that
Jonah
I liked
like
it.
Cringe. Yeah. I get it was a terrible joke, Jonah.
I enjoyed it.
Shut up.
But I was. I
Stop
led
projecting
you down
onto me.
The path. When I say prairie dog and I say in the field, I mean, what else is he going to say?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, Jonah. Seriously.
Blame me. Why are you blaming me?
Do you need me to hold up a mirror so you can yell at yourself?
You think I don't do that? There's no mirror in here right now.
Look Look at me doing that pun.
But I think... I think
it is, yes, maybe there's, look, maybe you hit that, but you start to overthink it, and you're like, is it more intellectual here, or is it, you know, because maybe monogamy is intellectual and not biological, or whatever, I don't know, all these things that everybody thinks about at different points.
Dating sucks.
And then there's that, too.
It sucks, and you know, just sleeping with someone doesn't make you feel better. It makes you feel worse, a lot of times worse, because you're like, I thought this was supposed to make me feel better, and I still feel empty, now I feel worse. Like,
right.
There's no, you know, I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you think about this idea of what does it mean to be a man?
Right.
And I think it's as simple as learning to just take responsibility for your actions. You know? And that means sometimes you fuck up. But as long as you can go, I fucked this up, but I want to make it better. And
And I think that was actually kind of what did happen. Well, and I also realized that this whole, I'm a man and I need to maybe, you know, sow my oats and, you know, hopefully there's a great oat famine right now, but when the oats are back in season,
I'm going to hit like one oat.
Yeah, I'll be right back. But women are of the exact same. I mean, that's the ignorant part too, I think, is like, sometimes guys think like, listen, settling down. Well, yeah, women are, you know, we're all here together. I mean, we're built differently, but not that, you know, that it's not, well, for some of us, it's very close physiologically. But yeah, no, I don't think that there's much. I think that the same desires and the same tendencies run rampant through both men and women. But I think at the end of it, I did come around and say, okay, well, I think the problem was that I wasn't taking responsibility for everything. I was saying like, that you know when people are like, look, I know I'm a bad person for saying this, but and it's like, that's such a cop out to say that.
Is that Nick Cage saying that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. I just really want to do Ghost Rider 3. I know I'm a bad person. Does it make me a terrible person for wanting to do this evangelical film? I just think Left Behind has a lot of life in it.
Now just say that there please just say there are clues on the money.
There are clues on the money. So I think at the end when you come back and you say, Jesus, I, you know, just saying I have these impulses. I have these desires. I did this thing. I don't know what I want. I can't, you know. Well, that's cool that you know how to be really honest, but that's not necessarily commendable.
Like, right.
Just being honest, if it's just to clear your conscience or it's just, it's like, that's...
selfish.
It's what they call selfish. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I didn't
when
know.
When you don't, like, people who say whatever they want and don't take into consideration another person's feelings or what it... Or is it organic to the situation? Yeah. Is something like a truthful
narcissism?
Person, yes, because a truthful person will answer a question on. I mean, an honest person will answer a question truthfully,
right?
And an asshole will just tell you whatever the fuck they think, whenever the fuck they think, regardless. Of
like anything. On Twitter sometimes too, or you know, whatever. Yeah, there's. You're like, well, what is this? To what end are we doing this? And I don't know. I experienced it too, like because. Still, you know, being what does it mean to? Because I have the tendency to call out, you know, like if I ever have like a meeting where I feel like this is so silly, like we're sitting at it. Look at how funny this is. We're all taking ourselves so seriously. We're at this big conference table, and life is so fucking stupid. Like, don't. How do we sit here and have a conversation? And then it turns into we're in a Japanese meeting. But no, but I mean, you start, and I always have to be like, oh man, you know, like I call out the thing on the way in, or I call out like I was in the elevator and, you know, it smelled weird and some girl, like, I feel like I have to kind of like lighten it, and I have to call out like, guys, like, do we really have to get, but, and I'm like, why am I doing that? I'm just being, you know, I was talking to my wife about it. I was like, I want to go in I had like some important thing where I wanted to say a bunch of like, hey, I feel that this is unjust and I want to make sure this happens. But I always have the tendency to be like, look, and guys, like, I love everybody, you know, who cares? I mean, like, we're all just being, we're all people trying to make our way. We all get in these little cars and then we drive there from here to there and molecules and existential and boop, and then we're, that's it. We're done. We're a blip on the radar. But, and my wife's like, yeah, but that's not, that isn't just being on, that's, you're insecure because you're actually, that's you not able to go in and say, I want these things, feeling confident in what you want. That's you having to undermine the whole situation.
You're trying to make it seem smaller.
Yeah, because you're being like, I'm a, like, yeah. Yeah. Like,
in the grand scheme of things, it's not important, but what I want.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Or just like, and so I don't know. And I guess I still have that tendency, like just being self-reflexive and self-deprecating, that doesn't make you a bigger person. It doesn't make you a smarter person. I mean, sometimes it's just fucking being selfish or it's just being insecure. Like, you know, self-deprecate, it's funny and stuff, but yeah, and then that's great. But I mean, at the end of it, don't you have to kind of stand up and, you know, just be still. Say what you want and don't modify it at the end of it.
Say stuff that you want without being a dick about it.
Yeah.
You can say, hey, it's really important to me if this happens and we can have a conversation. Again, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It's okay to have a conversation about things.
Yeah.
Most things are a compromise.
Right.
You know, this is what I want. Another entity says, well, this is what I want. Then you go, what's a reasonable way that we can both get something out of this and feel satisfied at the end of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's very rare because it's very rare that we do that. But
I do think scary.
It is scary. And I think because of the way that we interact so much with, you know, with media, with our phones, with everything, it's as much as there is a conversation that ultimately happens, it is a communication that is one direction that you're shooting into a screen. You're not really, it's just this is how I feel, this is how I feel, this is how I feel.
Right. Yeah. Well, and and that's part of the problem that I think. I mean, you know, I know it's probably such a tired topic, but with like social media, with Instagramming and selfie and picture and everything and all of this, like the people start to remove themselves from their own life because it actually they're kind of eulogizing themselves as they live. So
they're documenting. Yeah. So much time documenting.
You used to have Facebook. You know, the byproduct of taking pictures or whatever was that Facebook existed. So maybe you post something because it from. But now it's like. No. Like you take pictures. You live in order to put it onto some sort of social media.
And the question is, for what? Like, what is it ultimately that you're trying to? Like, do you ever go back later and go, "Oh, I can't wait to see this thing. I can't wait to experience this thing again." It's rare that you actually go back and experience.
Right. Well, you're like taking a picture of yourself watching a play, and you're like, "Well, selfie that shit. This is gonna be great."
I just did that. Why would I do that on an audio podcast? A joke that isn't going to play.
No, it's so that is like deeply meta, and I like that. And it's only for us.
No, it was just for us.
And you're going to post that, and you're going to exploit me, aren't you?
No,
you're eulogizing yourself, Chris. You're alive. Live now for the moment.
If I looked better in the picture, I would.
Okay,
to be honest,
good.
But it didn't. The timing on it was bad, Simon. I just.
Well, you didn't have the camera to look.
No,
I'll show you
I had to futz with it, but I agree 100%. And by the way, I'm guilty of it too. It's like
sure.
Because
everybody gets, you know.
How many times have you been? This I'm so ashamed to admit this, but how many times have you seen a beautiful vista or been to a beautiful park or something? And your first thought is, I got to take a picture of this. And
right.
Then you start feeling the pressure of like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to take the right picture to capture this moment in the way that I'm feeling it. But by that point, you're not feeling it anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, and I mean, obviously our attention spans are, I mean, it is changing our brain chemistry and whatever. There's a lot of wonderful positive things, but I don't know. It's scary. It also triggers that part of my brain too in high school where I was just always panicked that there was something better, that there was a party or I wasn't going to be invited or somebody was saying something behind my back or did somebody like the thing I did or just, and sometimes I find myself, it's that same feeling on, you know, social media where you're like, ah, and that quest for validation and the thing. And then they're, oh, why are those two people talking on Twitter? Like, oh, well, they don't like me. Like they don't know, or, you know, or whatever it is. And I don't think that's really healthy because if your heart rate goes up when you check Twitter or if it goes down or, you know, or your self-worth has any fluctuation while you're on any of these things, I don't think that's a great way to live. And I think a lot of people, you know, do that the first thing in the morning
but it just goes back to where you're placing your identity. And if you're placing your identity in the validation of other people at any cost, you are not going to live a happy life.
Yeah. It's just harder than ever, I think, to avoid it. That's kind of there's always been a version of it. And, you know, it used to maybe celebrity was a way you would get out there on a big platform and, you know, say like, daddy, do you love me now or whatever. But now, you know, you can say like followers. I mean, can you imagine like 20 years ago, if you overheard somebody be like, I got 800,000 followers. You'd be like, oh, it's Charles Manson.
How many likes do you get? How many likes do you have?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the prophets talked about, it's weird. But you know, hey, here we are. So.
Yeah. But you know, I think it just sort of plays into, the dark side is all fear-based and insecurity-driven, and the best thing that we can do is, as we get older and wiser, is just realize like, it doesn't really say anything about who you are. And,
it's
okay, and I think it's great that you made because in your position, you must get offered stuff.
Yeah, there are things. It's hard. It's also scheduling, like, is challenging just because of the show and summertime.
But to pick a thing that meant something to you that really is an expression of something that was personal to you I'm sure there was probably something that you may have turned down that was more money, potentially more notoriety, whatever. And you were like, I don't need that. I just want this thing that means something to me.
Yeah, yeah. It took, you know, and it took some time. It took some years to do it, and we had a baby in the middle and we had to, you know, postpone it. And it was like, it was definitely a labor of love and dysfunctional love and all of that. And it came out, you know, it came out the way we wanted it to come out. So.
Have you guys, well, you must have. Have you actually just sat down and watched it alone together and been like,
oh God, that's like the last thing we'd ever wanted to do. I mean, because I guess, you know, you're editing, you're in a room for so many months and it's like all you do is watch it by yourself. And so you're like, you hate it by the end and you can't tell what's happening, if it's working or you don't know what you're watching.
Because you're this far from it.
Yeah. And it's also like, it is a comedy. It's got some darkness and some real gritty kind of honesty and painful moments in it, but it is a comedy. And then you lose perspective. And so we went, the first time we got to watch it with an actual audience was at South by Southwest, and it was like one of the best nights of my whole life. It was amazing. It was, the place went too crazy, actually. It was like it was like a rock concert. We didn't, you know, it might have been a little disproportionate to what a normal audience. I don't know what it was about it, but they went absolutely nuts. And And we got this incredible response, and it was like exactly the kind you wanted. They laughed. It was like – because the laughs in the movie are more of like the forehead slapping laughs. Like we want people to have welts on their forehead because it's a lot of no, go, because it's just me fucking up every 5 minutes. And they followed it, and they were like – you know, there's always those moments in movies where you're like, if they get – if they're with it this moment, then they get the movie. Or
right.
And it happened, you know, immediately, and it was like – that was a success. And we were like, you know what? Whatever happens from here on out, we made a movie that tells a story that people like, you know. And then we got to see it in like in Edinburgh and this opera. We were at the film festival there, and there was like this opera house and men in tuxedos. And I never expected one man in a tuxedo to watch this movie, let alone 500 or whatever. But it was so those are the moments where you're like, this works, and this is why we did it. And it's like I kind of don't want to see it. Like, I mean, maybe in some years and some time, but like it's a great way to kind of finish the journey, is to experience it with a group of people who don't know you and don't know your story and know that it works for them too. And we got a wide range of really people moved, and people thought it was hilarious. People thought it was so painful. People, I mean, it was great. So that's all I guess you can hope for. And but I mean, it's not easy. I think you have to be compelled like a lunatic to make a movie. I mean, I think you really kind of have to go, you know, into the asylum and break out in order to make the movie, and then check back in after, heal, put on that weight that you lost, and and then go, you know, promote it.
Well, you look great.
I thank you. The weight's coming back on, actually.
And I'm very excited for you. And as I said, you know, all of my encounters with you have been so great, and we've had dinner a couple times.
We
and
have.
We should do that again. And I really would like to see you do a one-man show called Cage Match, where you just... do it's sort of it's like the like when Ben Stiller did the Tom Cruise what was it called?
Cruise Up in Lights, the
on
the Ben Stiller show.
The one man show
called Up in Lights, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
But he does all the like the risky business.
Yes, come on and cruise along with me, and then he winks at the camera. Right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean the Cage. It would be great because also like through the years of Cage too. Like I mean the looks, and the styles,
hair.
And oh my god, I mean it was. Somebody released a thing online. It was like, can you guess? Can you guess the Cage movie? And it was just the hair, like silhouettes of the hair cut out, like draw, like kind of like, you know, drawing like a silhouetted sort of just a version of the hair with his face missing. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I did really well on it, but I don't want to brag.
My wife did very well at it too.
I've seen way too many movies, but well, we'll do that. Let's do a Cage Match thing.
We'll do it. Simon Helberg. It was wonderful to see you.
You too.
As we exit the Nerdist podcast.
Thank you.
Don't document this. Just enjoy it. Just enjoy your burrito. Don't document the burrito.
Don't take a picture of it. Eat it. That's what's there for.
Are we documenting it, though, by recording this and putting it out there?
Well, yeah. But
we're recording
how
this?
We do it.
So it's cool if we do it, but not anyone else.
Yeah. No. We're doing this for them to experience. We're documenting the thing for them to experience.
Yeah, but if we're doing that, but if we... But if we're doing it so that people like it and enjoy it, is that selfish? Are we doing it for selfish reasons?
Yes. Oh.
I did not know people were going to hear that. You know what? If you're listening to this, please take a selfie of yourself listening to this and put it up on my Twitter page.
That's Simon Helberg.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.